In the next hour, we'll hear Michael Schumann's talk at the Vermont State House on Tuesday, November 18th. The title of the talk is Small Mart Entrepreneurship, or How Vermont Can Prosper While the Global Economy Melts Away. Michael Schumann is with Training and Development Corporation in Maine, a national, not-for-profit think tank, design shop, and management company founded in 1975. The talk has been edited to shorten it from just over an hour to just under an hour. Here's Michael Schumann.
The underlying theme in all of this is something that, it's a phrase that we're now seeing circulate around the internet, and that is that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And indeed, when we look at, I think, just four of the kinds of crises that we have faced over the last year, we see that inside these crises are incredible opportunities for local business and local economy building. So, example number one, this is the price of West Texas crude oil. I'm behind a couple of weeks, so that number has gone down still further. But this is a short-term dip. I mean, I think everyone in this room understands that a year from now, the price of oil could easily be back to where it was last summer if the economy begins to get back on track. Higher oil prices, of course, are bad news for those on a limited income, but great news for local economies, because we're going to be using our non-local automobiles less, we're going to be doing more smart growth, we're going to be growing more home-based businesses, and local production that is linked to local distribution is going to be more cost-effective than Walmart production in China that brings goods 15,000 miles to the United States. So huge opportunities are going to be opening up for things that we are importing now. Second example, global climate disruption. Obviously a source of great concern to everyone in this room, but the solution, we all know, is not exclusively, but largely about alternative energy production. And the thing is that we know already how to do alternative energy production, both in terms of efficiency and in micropower. This, by the way, was one of the most vapid areas of the presidential debate, with John McCain advocating the building of 300 nuclear power plants 50 nuclear power plants with $300 billion of guaranteed federal money. And Barack Obama not really challenging that number at all. Just to build one of those nuclear power plants would cost, in the end, in just capital costs, about 27 cents a kilowatt hour. That's kind of competitive with photovoltaics right now. And when you start putting in wind power is much more cost effective than that. We have a wind power resource in this country that is twice the size of current electricity demand. We have, if you just put today's inefficient photovoltaics on a 100 mile by 100 mile square of the Arizona desert, you could produce all of the electricity that we're using today. Cost-effective cogeneration around existing industry at the local level would be enough to displace existing nuclear power. So we've got all kinds of micropower opportunities, and I think we're fortunate to be in a state where a lot of innovation, a lot of implementation has been taking place. A third crisis, the shrinking dollar. The shrinking dollar is good news in some respects because it means, again, we're going to be importing less. Imports are becoming less affordable. And there are huge new opportunities for growing more domestic industry. Finally, there is the financial crisis. The financial crisis is bad news for all of us with pension funds, but it's good news because we've identified certain segments of the financial universe that we know work, and we now have confidence are relatively risk-free. For example, local banks and local credit unions did not do predatory lending. They do not put their loans into secondary markets, by and large. They are not responsible for the derivatives that have taken down the global economy. So while the mainstream financial sector has been collapsing, what remains and what can be grown in the next generation of local economy building is local banking and other pieces of local financial institutions. And we'll come back to that in a little bit. Out of all of these opportunities has emerged a national movement for local living economies. And this has been the clarion call of an organization I've been with from the outset, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, or BALI. BALI was started in the year 2001. It currently has 70 communities that are member networks. Formally, those networks represent about 15,000 local businesses, but informally, if you looked at all of the local businesses inside those member areas, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of businesses that are part of this national movement right now. Now, the philosophy of BALI can really be summarized in three ideas. The first is that the most successful economy is going to be the one that maximizes the number and the power of locally owned businesses. And I'll say more about that in a moment. Second, our philosophy of localization is not isolation from the rest of the planet. It's not isolation. But it's a philosophy that says the strongest economy is going to be as self-reliant as possible and as engaged in the world as possible. Local markets, global markets. The final piece about BALI's philosophy is we're not just in favor of any local businesses willy-nilly, we're in favor of businesses with high labor and environmental standards. What I would like to do in the next few minutes is really run through two themes. One is that the case for local living economies as a centerpiece for economic development is strengthening. And it's strengthening to the point where any other philosophy around economic development probably should be dismantled. And that means much of what you're doing in the name of economic development in this state right now. The second point that I want to make is that there is an emerging set of ideas and strategies around local economy building, most of which are not being done in this state, and ought to inform how one rethinks economic development here. So let's first talk about the strengthening case for local living economies. I've just finished a two-year study for the Kellogg Foundation on what does economic development really look like around the United States. We looked at the three largest economic development programs in 15 states. Some of the states we only had data for a year, some 2 years, some 3 years. In all, we looked at 84 program years in these 15 states. Vermont, by the way, was not one of them. If you ask the question, in what percentage of the programs spent a majority or more of the money on locally owned business? The answer is fewer than 10% of the programs. 90% of the programs are spending most of their money on attraction or retention of outsider-owned businesses. And in most of those cases, it's well over 90% of the money. Is this money going for the right thing? I would argue no. And when I say no, I'm not saying that there's anything that's bad or nasty about these global businesses. Frankly, from an economic development standpoint, I think the philosophy ought to be you welcome everybody, but But in terms of public money and energy, it ought to be focused laser-like on what we know works best, and that is local living economies. Now, why do I say that local living economies have a better economic development punch than do outside our own businesses? Let's look at three reasons to start with. The first is locally owned businesses are more reliable. They do not have ambitions to move to Mexico and Malaysia. I think a nice illustration of the impact of that comes from a debate that I had with the head of economic development for Lane County, Oregon, about 6 years ago. And I was very fortunate that before our debate, the local newspaper, the Register Guard, presented data on the performance of his economic development activity over about 5 years. He had given out several million dollars of tax abatements over this period. 95% of the tax abatements went to six non-local businesses. Three came, took the benefits, and within a year or two shut down and moved to Asia. Two came, took the benefits, and under-delivered the jobs that they promised, and one was sort of on target. The other 5% of the tax abatements went to about 100 local businesses. They made very modest promises and, by and large, kept the promises that they made. The bottom line that's demonstrated by this graph here is that in tax abatement terms, the cost of a local job was $2,000. The cost of all of the jobs generated over the 5 year period from the non-local attraction was $22,000. But remember, some of those jobs came and went. So if you looked in net job terms at the end of the 5 years, it was $67,000 a job, 30 times more expensive to get a job from outside attraction than local indigenous development. Now, is this just bad luck for Oregon? I don't think so. And I almost guarantee you that if you did a similar analysis of the cost effectiveness of Vermont's economic development programs, you would find an equivalent disparity in what the relative efficacy was of a dollar spent on a reliable business that's going to stay here for many years, if not many generations. Second difference with local businesses. Local businesses have higher economic multipliers. Now, most of you know what a multiplier is. For those of you who don't, a multiplier means that if I spend a dollar at a local pharmacy, they have people working at the pharmacy, buy local food, people who are consuming the local food, maybe in turn have their dollar go to the farmer who buys local seeds, and so we have a dollar that is circulating in the economy. The more times this dollar circulates locally, the faster that it circulates without leakage, the more income, wealth, and jobs. That's economic development 101 in a nutshell. It just so happens that local businesses do this far more effectively than non-local businesses. And this is kind of the granddaddy study done 6 years ago by Civic Economics on this question, looking at the impact of two bookstores in Austin, Texas, a proposed Borders, non-local, and an existing local bookstore. $100 spent at the Borders would leave $13 in the local economy. $100 spent at the local bookstore would leave $45 in the local economy. So roughly speaking, every time you buy the exact same book at the local bookstore, you get three times the jobs, three times the income and the wealth effects, three times the tax benefits. We're not talking about small potatoes of difference. There have been a dozen studies done on this question over the last 10 years, some outside the United States. The numbers vary, as you would expect, from place to place, but they all point in exactly the same direction. Local businesses have higher multipliers because they spend more of their money locally. In this case, the Borders did not have a high-level management team on the ground. The local bookstore did. The Borders did not advertise on local radio and TV. The local bookstore did. The Borders did not use local business services like lawyers and accountants. The local bookstore did. The Borders did not have a stream of profits coming into the community. The local bookstore did. Just those four line items could easily constitute 15, 20, 25% of the expenditure of a business. And you can see it would really be an oddball comparison of similar local versus non-local businesses where you would get a higher multiplier from the non-local business.
If you're just tuning in, we're listening to Michael Schumann's talk, Small Mart Entrepreneurship, or How Vermont Can Prosper While the Global Economy Melts Away. Schumann spoke at the Vermont State House on Tuesday, November 18th.
I did a study last year in Detroit looking at the impact of a 20% shift in consumer expenditure in the city to Detroit-grown food. As many of you know, Detroit is a city that was built for 2 million people. Today there are fewer than 1 million people living there, a lot of abandoned land, abandoned buildings. And yet, a remarkable thing is that people, perhaps out of desperation and necessity, are beginning to do farming on some of this land. So there's a greening of Detroit. And the question was, so if you got a 20% shift of residents in Detroit toward this Detroit-grown food, what would be the impact? Turns out it's 5,000 jobs. Now suppose you got the five surrounding counties around Detroit in the name of regional solidarity to also move toward 20% consumption of Detroit grown. That would be 40,000 jobs. This could be the most significant economic development policy to hit the Motor City. And to think that all the city founding fathers can think about for the last 20 years is casinos. And all they're thinking about now is a bailout of the automobile industry, and this kind of stuff is getting no attention whatsoever. It's outrageous. A third feature about locally owned businesses. Because local businesses tend to buy goods locally, there's less shipping of the inputs into the local businesses and less shipping outside of them. That means less energy use, less carbon emissions. Now, there have been a number of cutesy articles in the press over the last year or two saying, well, generally, yes, localization means a lower carbon footprint, but there's so many exceptions. How can you support localization? And a classic example of this is in the New York Times op-ed page two summers ago. There was a piece where the author said, great new study out that shows that if you buy lamb from New Zealand and you're living in Great Britain, the local lamb would have four times the carbon impact as you're importing New Zealand lamb. Therefore, we need to keep importing New Zealand lamb. And you can find variations on this study, you know, with apples and other stuff. They're still quoted widely. Now, I was very interested in this study and decided to do something that the editors of the New York Times did not do, which is actually read the study. First of all, guess who published it, who financed it? Yes, the New Zealand Lamb Export Association. This was their home run. What did they look at? They looked at badly done bionic industrial lamb in the United Kingdom versus badly done industrial lamb in New Zealand. And it turns out that the industrial lamb in New Zealand, because so many of the electricity intensive inputs use clean hydropower, these are sort of green bionic lambs. Whereas in the United Kingdom, because the electricity inputs come from coal, they're dirty bionic lamps. But they never looked at local food. They never looked at local organic lamb growing. Little oversight, huh? And this is the kind of stuff that you find in a lot of these studies that purport to show the fallacy of localization. There have been some good studies done on carbon footprints, by the way. This study from the University of Washington a year ago looking at two plates of food, both plates having fish, potatoes, vegetables, fruit, one local, one imported, and the imported plate, not surprisingly, has 50% more carbon footprint than the local plate of food. There's a lot of other advantages to local living economies that we really don't have time to get into the weeds of. But, you know, every great model that you create in this state for local food or local energy is a model that others around the world can learn from. In fact, you should think about everything that you're modeling around self-reliance as an economic development policy that is the best thing for helping to pull people in poverty around the planet out of poverty through self-reliance. Tourism is inherently driven by local business. Creative economies, the work of Richard Florida that says the best and the brightest stay in an economy that's diverse, tolerant, that has a lot of entrepreneurial opportunities. Well, at the end of the day, that is a small business economy. Civil society, what Bill McKibben argues around, is enhanced by the marketplace activities of local business. There's a sociology literature that says that an economy that largely is locally owned has higher degrees of social equality, less civil strife, and a political science literature that says that locally owned economies have higher degrees of voting participation and other forms of non-voting political engagement. That's a pretty long and impressive list of things that comes out of local ownership of business. And what I would argue is, given that long list, why would you spend a penny on attraction or retention of non-local business, let alone most of what you're spending for economic development right now? Your priorities make absolutely no sense. But what about the competitiveness of local businesses? And, you know, believe it or not, most of what I've shared with you actually is relatively uncontroversial. That is to say, you know, as I go around in the bully pulpit, discuss, debate, do panels with people, most of the points that I've just shared with you are conceded. But what skeptics come back with and say, well, yes, all things being equal, a local potato versus a non-local potato. Yes, the local potato, you will get greater wealth effects, greater multiplier, more reliability, tourism, civil society, creative economy, and so forth. But we live in an era where bigger is better, bigger box is cheaper, bigger businesses achieve higher economies of scale. And the argument is essentially that local businesses can't compete. Local businesses have more expensive goods and services. There's a lot to say about this, but in the interest of time, I just want to present one counter-argument. Every year, the U.S. government collects data on 1,100 sectors in our economy that it calls the North American Industrial Classification System, or NACE. So an interesting question is, in how many of these 1,100 NACE categories do we have more examples of competitive large business than small business? The answer is 7. In other words, in 1,093 categories, we have more examples of competitive small business than large business. So what are the 7 categories that are really hard to localize? Number one on the list is running your own centralized monetary system. I know a lot of you really do want to do that, so I'm not saying it's off the table. But number two, running your own nuclear power plant. Okay, we can concede that one. Number three is missiles and rockets. And surely, if there was a category that would be hard to localize, it would be one with an intergalactic mission. And yet, there are 10 of these businesses in the United States, and three are small and locally owned. So that one is open to you. My real point here is that economists are really cavalier about this concept of economies of scale, as if you go up on, Mount Economus and pull down the word from the Lord and says, thou shalt not do small-scale local manufacturing. Doesn't work like that. And the smart economic developer in a small state like this looks for the brilliant examples of small-scale success in every one of these sectors. And that's how you build a brilliant, diversified, successful economy. There's a bunch of other trends that are favoring local business. We don't have time to get into them, but just to mention a few of them. As oil prices get more expensive, shipping prices go up, that's going to push us toward localization. We naturally have been shifting in this country from goods to services. Today, the typical household spends two-thirds of its budget on services. A generation ago, two-thirds was on goods. Those of you who are in love with manufacturing complain about this, but at the end of the day, it's great news for local economies because services are an inherently local activity. Yeah, there's a little bit of internet niche stuff that happens, but services is one area where we have run a surplus nationally for the last 10 years. The internet economy allows a growing number of people to do almost anything from their homes. That's a big difference to a rural economy like Vermont. There's a greater premium on trust. The importation of deadly dog food from China or mad cows from Canada has really driven a lot of our interest in local food. Even homeland security, at the end of the day, is about creating resilient local supplies of basic necessities. So let's turn to the second part of what I wanted to share with you, which is that if we can concede that local living economies are what the focus of economic development should be, what then ought we be doing in economic development to support local living economies? And I have a kind of menu that is summarized in six P's: planning, people, partners, purse, by which I mean investment, purchasing, and policy making. And in each of the categories, there would require a little bit of a change in what you're doing right now. So leakage analysis means you would seriously examine, consistent with the quote that was read before I started talking, all of the places you are unnecessarily importing outside goods and services, and identify opportunities for local business import substitution. People. We would focus entrepreneurship programs laser-like on local business and try, and this is the partnership piece, to put those businesses together in networks like VBSR, like Vermont Local First, that enables those businesses to be more competitive working together than they ever could be if they remain apart. Purse. Half of the economy is local small business. Half of things that are making significant profit in the economy are local small business, and none of our pension money is going into those businesses. This is what an economist might dryly observe is a market failure. And this failure comes from securities laws that were enacted in the early Jurassic period that make it extremely expensive, except for lawyers, for small investors to place small bits of money in small businesses. And that's clearly something we need to change here. Purchasing. How do we get people to think local first? And I'll say more about that in a second. And policy making, I have a really simple policy objective that I would encourage the Vermont legislature to think about. Stop destroying local business. Simply enacting a level playing field between local and non-local businesses would be a home run and a sea change from what you're doing right now. So I want to give you one example of each of these things, just to give you a sense of the richness of this agenda. So, leakages.
If you're just tuning in, we're listening to Michael Schumann's talk, Small Mart Entrepreneurship, or How Vermont Can Prosper While a Global Economy Melts Away. Schumann spoke at the Vermont State House on Tuesday, November 18th. He now refers to the results of the so-called leaky bucket study of Vermont's economy conducted by Doug Hoffer in the year 2000.
Every year in this largely agrarian state, there's $2 billion of food that you're importing. Looking at the middle bar, in a state rich with solar, wind power, biofuel potential, you're importing something like $1 billion worth of energy a year. The smallest number on the left is interest that Vermonters pay on credit cards coming from out-of-state banks. That's $250 million a year. What a leakage analysis begins to tell you is, you know, starting from right to left, these are the big things that we can start systematically plugging the leaks in. These are the things that will have gigantic multiplier impacts once we start doing the import substitution. Now, before I get into the next bunch of things, I want to suggest that economic development has been misconceived. You know, these are the great promoters of entrepreneurship, but they are the least entrepreneurial people in the state, with a few exceptions like Bruce Seifer here. But economic development needs to be a line item that generates its own money. If you are begging for money year in, year out, from the state, from private foundations, how are you modeling the entrepreneurship that you're expecting from everyone else in the state? I think that we can model it, and the way to model it is to think of projects that I call meta-businesses. Meta-businesses are businesses whose mission is economic development. They are cash-flowing businesses. So a great example of a meta-business is this coupon book from Bellingham, Washington, Where the Locals Go. Now in its 8th edition, this coupon book has coupons from about 700-800 local businesses. If you use all the coupons, you save probably $7,000-$8,000. This is the best-selling book in the local bookstores, and this project makes money. Doesn't cost money, it makes money. Now that to me is a model of how we can start to think about other forms of economic development. So I want to approach the people, partners, person, purchasing ideas from the standpoint of what would be susceptible to meta-business ideas. So let's talk about local first. Start with the purchasing piece, since that's really what most of us are familiar with. First, I want to say a word about what local first is and isn't. This is a term, a campaign that those of us in Bali thought long and hard about what we wanted to frame it as. We did not want a campaign that said, buy local. We didn't want a campaign that said, buy local irrespective of the cost. We didn't want a campaign that said, buy local or you suck. It was think local first. The goal here is to help individuals, businesses, government purchasing agents uncover all of those great deals at the local level that they were overlooking because of the tidal wave of advertising we get from the non-local players. Now, there are a lot of meta-business ideas out there that I think are worth looking at. These pictures here are of local business debit cards. The one in the upper part of the slide is from Santa Fe, the local CARES card. And then the lower half is the Intera card, a local credit card that's being prototyped in a few places in New England and the Pacific Northwest. Each of these cards rewards you with loyalty and points and discounts every time you use it at a local business. The bank in Santa Fe that launched the Locals Care card put $100,000 into it. And their theory was is that enough Santa Fe residents would move to this card that this would have a bump in convincing people to move their accounts from Bank of America to this local bank. And they were right. In 2 years, this bank moved from number 4 in the market to number 1 in the market. 1 out of 10 residents of Santa Fe carries this card. And this card has generated hundreds of thousands of dollars for charity, and it will, over time, I believe, be a moneymaker. A local gift card. We have all kinds of gift cards in this country that are moneymakers, that chambers of commerce do. But the organizing principle around these cards is the local siting of business, which means, you know, Walmart and Target are as much a part of it as the local coffee shop. We need to reorganize these cards exclusively around local businesses. Business-to-business midwifing. In the state of Oregon in the 1980s, in the early 1990s, there was a program called the Oregon Marketplace. Basically, what they were doing is going around to businesses in the state and saying, tell me all of the places where you're buying your inputs into your business. I see you're making flags and you're importing cloth from outside the United States. Suppose we found you a similar cloth manufacturer in this country. In Oregon, same price, same quality. Would you do the switch? Sure, they'd say. And then the Oregon Marketplace took a finder's fee from the recipient of the new contract in Oregon. At the peak of their operation, they were doing something like $20 million of input substitution contracting each year. Now that is a project that took place in a pre-internet era. And it's a project that is waiting to happen again in Vermont or New England, however you want to frame it. Business-to-government contracting. You're already doing some of it in farm-to-school programs, but we need to more comprehensively organize small businesses and farmers to supply a wider range of goods and services to government entities. And, you know, I believe, again, that these entities could charge a finder's fee for every successful contract, take care of the paperwork, and take care of a lot of the rigmarole that otherwise scares away small businesses from getting involved in this. Okay, let's talk about some partnership meta-businesses. What about local businesses working together to buy things jointly and thereby bringing down the costs of their business? You know, for example, that True Value Hardware stores compete successfully against Home Depot. True Value Hardware stores are locally owned hardware stores, but they are part of a national producer cooperative that, just like Home Depot, goes around the planet looking for good deals, buys in bulk, and delivers those savings to the member stores. We just need more of these kinds of arrangements in other kinds of categories of business. Tucson Originals is a collection of local businesses in Tucson, Arizona, food businesses that collectively buy foodstuff together and kitchen equipment and dishes and thereby bring down their costs of production. In Washington, D.C., the local Bali Network buys green power collectively for the member businesses and brings down the costs. What about investment meta-businesses? Well, we know how to create credit unions in a profitable way. What about creating more of them to make up for the global banks going under? Community loan funds. Now, there are a bunch of community loan funds in this state, including the one that's sponsoring this event, but we're going to need more of them. They can only touch a fraction of the available business opportunities. And in an era of depleted credit, I think we need to be much more creative about creating our own credit. And a great example of this comes from Great Barrington, Massachusetts, not from Joe the plumber, but from Frank the deli owner. This is a story that happened about 15 years ago. Frank lost his lease to his deli. He needed several tens of thousands of dollars to get a new lease. And his kid had cancer, so he had no financial resources. So working with the E.F. Schumacher Society, they designed what were called deli dollars, this little note here. And the idea was you'd give $9 today for $10 of food from Frank in 6, 9, or 12 months. So, you know, it was different bond rates, but they had fairly significant payoffs. Well, these things not only were bought up immediately, allowing Frank to move the deli, but these things also started to go into circulation as currency. People started to use their deli bucks to go to the movies or for the plumber. It shows the close relationship conceptually between debt and currency. And a lot of creative activity remains to be done at the local level in issuing more debt and more currency based on the businesses and the people who live there. Angel recruiters. There are rich people living in this state. What have you organized comprehensively to expose those wealthy individuals to the best local businesses in this state? Why leave it willy-nilly in the hands, one business at a time, to do this when it ought to be done in a comprehensive way? What about a local venture fund? Now, some of you may recall that Tom's of Maine, a great local business, sold out about 2-3 years ago to Colgate-Palmolive. I really had wished that Vermont had had a fund, I'm sorry, that Maine had had a fund that immediately bought up Tom's from Tom Chappelle. And I think they could have, you know, this fund could have found a price that Tom could have lived with. And then the fund would turn around and gradually resell the shares of Tom's to local shareholders in Maine. But it would give you more time. Now, you can't do this at the last minute, but there are many valuable companies here that are going to go on the sale block at some point, and you want a fund in place preventatively so that you can respond to this and keep those businesses in the state when that happens. Now, a critical piece of this whole idea is local stock. By local stock, I mean stock, ownership certificates, equity certificates in companies that are bought within the state and only traded within the state. And an example of local stock is the Ben & Jerry's company. The first issue of Ben & Jerry's, you had to be a resident of Vermont to buy the shares. Now, unfortunately, in subsequent issues of Ben & Jerry's stock, they let go of that criterion and enabled the company to be hostily taken over by Unilever. If you start with local stock, you got to continue with it. And here, I think, is a happier story. This is of the Merck in Powell, Wyoming. Powell, Wyoming is a small community in the Rocky Mountains, so small they couldn't attract a general store like from Target or Kmart, a place where they could buy their socks and their underwear. So they decided, you know what, we're going to build our own general store. We need about $1 million to do it. So they decided to actually create their own local stock issue and sold the stock like Girl Scout cookies door to door, got the thing capitalized. This thing was profitable from year one and has been profitable ever since. It has been the model of a half dozen other local stock general stores in the Rocky Mountain states and a few others that are trying to get up and running in New England.
If you're just tuning in, we're listening to Michael Schumann's talk, Small Mart Entrepreneurship, or How Vermont Can Prosper While the Global Economy Melts Away. Schumann spoke at the Vermont State House on Tuesday, November 18th.
Now, once we get a critical mass of local stocks happening, maybe we want to create a local stock exchange. How about a Vermont Stock Exchange, 2010? It doesn't have to be a brick-and-mortar institution. It can be an internet-based institution. You can go online now and find examples of, like, prosper.com or kiva.org, examples of where we do internet offerings and buyings of small-scale debt. But what about moving into small-scale equity? Technologically, we know how to do it. But legally, the SEC is not so happy with this. So it leads me to, actually, I mean to go to this slide next, but I'll come back to the other one. It leads me to believe that from a public policy standpoint, we have to legalize localization. And here's my proposition. We should ask the SEC for a complete waiver of all filings related to small investments in micro business. Complete exemption. Just as an experiment. So let's take businesses, say, of under $250,000 in capitalization. Let's say that, you know, any person could buy up to $100 of stock in that. I mean, what kind of risk are you taking? You take a bigger risk when you go to Denny's. And let's say that, you know, it only applies to local stock. Why should the SEC care? Now, we could do some things in this state to start facilitating this, okay? We could allow, for example, cooperatives to start investing in these kinds of micro businesses. So existing cooperatives could begin to serve as investment funds for people's pensions. We could create very simple techniques for people to issue local stock. In New Mexico, a local stock issue costs $200 and a postage stamp. Here, it's much more expensive. This is a regulatory reform that could come from this chamber. A local stock exchange. We could ask the SEC for special permission to set up a microbusiness stock exchange in this state. And here's an idea about how to kick the whole thing off, which is with a modest tax credit. You know, in the state of Maine, there's a 40% tax credit for anyone who puts money, that is any resident of Maine who puts money in a qualified Maine business. 40% tax credit. What is a qualified Maine business? Well, if you have an advanced manufacturer with a local branch factory, that qualifies. If you have a global bank with a branch in Maine, that qualifies. But if you have a genuine local business, does not qualify. That's outrageous. But it does lead to the thought that a 20-word amendment in the state code in Maine that said, hear ye, from here on in, the only businesses we're allowing this tax credit for is locally owned business. Wow. Suddenly, every investment institution in the state would try to figure out how can we take advantage of this tax credit. And frankly, I think 40% is far too high. How about 5%? Something really nominal. A 5% tax credit for Vermont residents who put their money in genuine local business would prime the pump for all of this legal and institutional reform that could open the way of billions of dollars coming into local business in the state. And unless you start paying attention to the security side of reform, I don't see how the green revolution that everyone is talking about can possibly take place. Just a few other legislative ideas, since we're in the hallowed halls of legislation here. Planning. And this is running through, again, the six P's of things that are easy to do, cheap to do, that would be home runs for local economic development. So planning. How about giving every community in this state better data so that they can calculate their own leakages and see what opportunities there are for import substitution? People. How about serious investment coming from the state, not in outside recruitment, but in local incubators that were self-financing? Partnership. How about more support for local business alliances throughout the state? PERS. We've talked about pension fund reforms. Purchasing. Encouraging government to selectively procure local goods and services. And by the way, I don't favor giving local businesses an unfair advantage in public procurement. But what I do favor is that with every bid, the government should also ask what percentage of this contract will be spent in the state. And then you can calculate objectively what is the multiplier, what is the expected tax receipts, and you adjust the price objectively. Now, the truth is that a non-local business that spent all of its money locally could do very well. So it's not discriminatory. But the reality is that the local businesses will be spending more of their money locally and will naturally get the advantage that they deserve in the procurement process. So there are ways to structure this consistent with the requirements of the World Trade Organization and other kinds of contract law. And policy making. Look, everything on this list costs a little bit of money. Costs some money to do leakage analysis, to do incubators, to set up business alliances, to do local stock markets, to set up local first programs. But none of these things, frankly, cost very much money. You could take the money that you are wasting on outside recruitment, put that money in these things and give money back to the Vermont taxpayer and do great from an economic development standpoint. So I believe what is next is for you folks to act. And I want to give you two quick examples, one in this country and one outside this country, of what success can look like. Gusing, Austria, is a community that has about 4,000 people. It's a pretty poor former forestry, former agricultural community. And they decided back in the 1980s that they were going to rebuild their economy around import substitution. And they started with energy. So they created a local district heating system using wood as a fuel for that. And with the money that they were able to save from that, they started to invest in other businesses. Flash forward 25 years, this community of 4,000 people has created 1,000 jobs and 50 new businesses. And they've done all of this and at the same time reduced their carbon footprint 95%. 95% reduction in their carbon footprint with 1,000 new jobs. Here's another example. Zingerman's, a delicatessen in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The first day Zingerman's operated in the 1970s, they sold $100 worth of corned beef sandwiches. Not very much. Today, Zingerman's sells $27 million worth of stuff a year. Almost 600 people work in Zingerman's. And Zingerman's has not taken its success and developed cookie-cutter models all over the country like Schlotsky's. Zingerman's has said, you know what? We're going to go deep. We're going to show how staying local, keeping everything that is unique about our business, can lead to enormous prosperity. And what they did is they systematically looked at all of the things that they were bringing into the deli. Things like bread, or cakes, or ice cream. And they built businesses around that. And then they looked at the other side of the deli, food that's coming out of there, and they built a restaurant. They're thinking about a hotel, doing a publishing company, a consult company. The Zingerman's community of businesses shows how just one remarkable business in a small place, if it is systematically looking at how do I substitute for inputs, how do I take advantage of value-added opportunities of things coming out of the business, you can get a home run just from one business that does it right in your community. I think that the agenda that I've just given to you, while simple and affordable, is nevertheless a revolutionary one. And that's why I want to leave you with a revolutionary quote that I use in the Small Mart Revolution from Patrick Henry, with only one minor edit. "Why stand we here idle? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me community or give me death." Thank you.